Penguin Random House Audio presents The Lead, Dispatches from a Life in the Press, by Calvin Trillin. Read for you by Robert Fass. In memory of Edward Corin, artist, firefighter, mensch. Introduction. In the pre-Google era, when someone in my family needed to find, say, an obscure fact or an unlisted telephone number, one of my daughters was likely to say, "Let Daddy do it. He's practically a trained reporter." When the task was something like composing a note to a teacher, I got what some would consider a slight upgrade, although it too included a qualifier. "Daddy can do it. He's nearly a professional writer." I think practically a trained reporter sums it up neatly. That is, if you include my training at Sarishan Hooley Secretarial School, where, according to the Kansas City Star, Ann Sarishan Hooley spent 37 years training Kansas City women to be valuable secretaries. When the Kansas City Public Schools closed around April one year because of lack of funds, my father decided that my sister and I should use that early release from high school to learn typing. In those days it was routine, of course, to train girls to be valuable secretaries. But why me? I've often said that my father's aspirations for me were clear early on. He wanted me to be the President of the United States, and his fallback position was that I not become a ward of the county. Neither of those positions requires typing. I like to think that journalism struck him as a conceivable middle course. Reporters do type, although from what I've gathered from old movies, in those days many of them did not devote more than two fingers to the task. I bring this up because I think it's incumbent upon anyone writing about his own field to reveal his predilections and experience in that field. For instance, I should mention that my own reporting for the past five or six decades has been overwhelmingly for magazines, and that magazine reporting is, compared to newspaper reporting, a lackadaisical calling. For 15 years, I did a 3,000-word piece for The New Yorker from somewhere in the United States every 3 weeks. When magazine writers heard that, they'd say, "How do you keep up that pace?" Newspaper reporters would say, "What else do you do?" I did work on the college newspaper, where I learned one version of objective journalism. We were equally inaccurate about both sides. I later learned another version from a photographer on a Little Rock paper. He said when he had an assignment to take someone's picture, he'd stop at the city desk and say, "Do you want him gazing out at the sunset or picking his nose?" The disparate nature of these pieces, some serious reporting pieces, some short pieces that are meant to amuse, what writers and editors at The New Yorker used to call casuals, some pieces that are somewhere in between, can be explained simply. I never got my act together. If I was working on, say, the sort of piece that The New Yorker runs under a rubric like A Reporter at Large, I could imagine a caricaturist depicting me with the type of hat reporters wore in those old black-and-white movies, a fedora that has a press pass jutting out of the hat band. The next day, writing a casual, the caricature shows me fully encased in a clown costume, big floppy shoes included. Some other day I'm in an incongruous outfit, the clown costume topped off with the fedora. I've been writing about the press almost as long as I've been in the game. In the early 60s, when I had a day job at Time, I was writing on the side for Monocle, a publication, I might mention, whose pay scale was so low that they once sent me a bill for a piece of mine they'd published. In a Monocle feature called Letters to Other Editors, I propounded a theory that The New Yorker purposely included in each issue one cartoon that wasn't funny at all, so that the reader would assume that he must be witnessing subtle humor beyond his power of perception, and that The New Yorker is therefore even more sophisticated than he thought. Some years later, after I'd moved to The New Yorker, Monocle had been replaced as a sideline by The Nation, where I wrote a column and eventually contributed what we called deadline poetry. The Nation was joined for a while by a magazine on the media called Brill's Content, where I wrote a column called The Wry Side. That title was not my idea. As someone who has often been referred to as wry by reviewers who are trying to be kind, I long ago decided that wry means almost funny. During the Brill's Content period, some prominent reporters and columnists on major papers were revealed as having played fast and loose with the facts, and I suggested that the Columbia School of Journalism might want to have etched in stone over its front entrance the motto, "Too good to check." Meanwhile, at The New Yorker, I regularly found myself writing about the press, a profile of a prominent homicide reporter here, a casual parodying newspaper correction columns there. At all of these publications, I had the freedom to write about what engaged me, which is why I've written about Beautiful Spot, a magazine of parking, but not about, say, the broader cultural implications of TikTok's appeal to American teenagers. At some point, it occurred to me that disparate pieces from various places in various styles amounted to a picture from multiple angles of what the press has been like over the years since I became a practitioner and an observer. I hope that is what this book provides. Part 1. The Trade. The Lead. 2021. It's said that when James Thurber, as a young newspaper reporter, was told by an editor that his story's first paragraph, what newspaper people might refer to as his lead, suffered from wordiness, he handed in a rewrite whose opening paragraph was, in its entirety, dead. There followed a second paragraph. That's what the man was when they found him with a knife in his back at 4 p.m. in front of Riley's Saloon at the corner of 52nd and 12th Streets. Like that editor, I admire those short, punchy leads often employed by crime reporters. But I also admire the ambition of those long leads, which you often see in the obituaries that appear in the New York Times, leads whose first sentence manages to stuff the highlights of an entire lifetime in a clause between the decedent's name and the fact that he has expired. You might say that I'm a collector of leads. I assume that's why my friend James Edmonds, who lives in New Iberia, Louisiana, sent me an article that appeared in The Advocate of Baton Rouge on September 23, 2019. If the function of a lead is to engage the reader, this article's lead seemed to me remarkably effective. Here it is. A veterinarian prescribed antibiotics Monday for a camel that lives behind an Iberville Parish truck stop after a Florida woman told law officers she bit the 600-pound animal's genitalia after it sat on her when she and her husband entered its enclosure to retrieve their deaf dog. Notice how the reader is drawn in with a single, unpunctuated sentence that starts slowly and gradually becomes an express train that whistles right by the local stops without providing an opportunity to get off. A veterinarian is summoned to administer antibiotics to a camel. Routine stuff so far. Yes, the camel lives behind a truck stop, which is an unusual domicile for a camel, but probably not unprecedented. It wasn't that long ago that gas stations along highways like Route 66 lured travelers with roadside zoos that were advertised by signs like "See Albino Raccoon" or "Live Two-Headed Goat." And this takes place in Louisiana, where animal stories that might be considered unusual elsewhere are commonplace. In 2007, when Louisiana finally banned cockfighting, the last state to do so, a state senator from Opelousas fought to exempt a less lethal version of the sport he called chicken boxing. Louisiana once tried to eat its way out of an environmental crisis caused by the nutria, an invasive rodent that devours marshland, by encouraging some of the state's celebrated chefs to invent tempting nutria dishes with names like Ragondin à l'orange. And then we come to the woman who bit the camel's genitalia and is talking to law officers, perhaps claiming self-defense as a way to wiggle.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?